This is Sunday Nights, exploring religion, ethics and society with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio.
Anata Rabbi Daniel Freelander, the president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. Rabbi Freelander leads the coordinating body of over 1.8 million Jews, representing almost 1,000 congregations around the world. He's based in the United States, but he was in Australia briefly last week and found time to join Noel Debien for a chat.
Let's start maybe with a general appreciation for the listener of what we're talking about when we talk about progressive Judaism. You're president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. Now, people understand that a pope has a button that you can press and get rid of a bishop. They might understand that a Uniting Church moderator must have many committees to do the same thing, but can get it done in the end. What does the role of president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism mean in what you can do, how you persuade, how you act, how you lead?
Well, every morning I wake up realizing that I have no authority whatsoever other than my bully pulpit. My ability to convince others that there are ways that we can build, strengthen, and utilize our religious communities, our congregations, for good. My work is to try to inspire leaders of congregations to make their congregations even more open, even more passionate, even more joyful, be it in their worship, be it in their social justice engagement, be it in their learning. I see my role as a pastor to pastors, to help congregational presidents and pastors and rabbis create the most vibrant religious community they can wherever they live. But I have no ability to impose my style or my opinions on them. Progressive Judaism is a bottom-up religion. Mm-hmm. It reflects that partnership between lay leaders in the congregation and the rabbi of the congregation. And that way, it's absolutely a democracy. I cannot impose a political position or a religious position in the congregations. The best I can do is to convince them that this is the direction that is useful for the congregation to move in.
If I'm doing my homework right, you lead roughly 1.8 million people officially.
Well, I attempt to. I don't know if they follow, but I try to lead.
Herding cats.
But where? Yes, and they're all spelled K-A-T-Z. The progressive movement is really post-sacrificial Judaism. All Judaism that follows the destruction of the temple in the year 70 AD is really progressive or reform Judaism. It's trying to adapt the biblical commands, the biblical prescriptions, to a world that has changed, where there's no longer central sacrifice to the temple in Jerusalem. It emerges from the same time period that Christianity emerges, when there were multiple sects, multiple groups trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that the Romans had taken over the religion that the Jews in Palestine had practiced for many years. So I see rabbinic Judaism, and that's the technical term we apply to all the interpretive texts that were written in the first, second, third centuries, right through the sixth century, that had to redefine Judaism in a non-sacrificial way where prayer replaced sacrifice.
And this means the temple is destroyed in 70 AD. There's a complete shake-off. The priesthood is gone. There will be no more fatted bullocks offered on the altar. In fact, the temple, just the wall is still there that we see on the news that people can touch and put a little prayer inside.
But even more complicated, there's no authority structure. With the priesthood, you knew who was in charge. You knew who to ask. You knew who would do the sacrifice appropriately, and all of a sudden, everyone became, in some terms, a priest. There was no longer an intermediary between God and the individual Jew. And that created, rabbinic Judaism is a series of texts where there are multiple opinions, and then the group of rabbis would decide what's the majority opinion, very much a democracy, and that would become what Jewish law is. So the Reform Jews of today, the progressive Jews of today, may be the individuals who participated in those second, third, fourth century conversations, but weren't always in the majority. Sometimes they were a majority, sometimes they were not, but their conversations are recorded. If you move forward now to the 18th century, emancipation, Jews all of a sudden don't have to live in a particular area of Europe. They're not under the control of the church. They're not under the control of any particular religious group. They're free to practice religion as they so choose. All of a sudden, there were no outside groups forcing them to live as Jews. And they had the opportunity now, and here we're talking about the late 1700s, early 1800s, to live anywhere they wanted, to practice any profession they wanted, and to practice any religion they wanted. And some Jews chose to immediately drop out of Judaism and chose to convert to Christianity. And other Jews broke into various sects, again, not unlike the first century, the year 70, where in the late 1700s and 1800s, the competing sects were groups like the Hasidic movement.
The Satmarim, the Ger, all these groups which were ethnically based but had particular rabbis
Chabad is the inheritor of that tradition. Mm. You have the modern Orthodox also emerges in that period, Samson Raphael Hirsch, to be a Jew in your home and a man on the street. Mm. And then you had Reform Judaism, which says we're going to update the practices in our synagogues and on our homes, so they're totally in confluence. It's not two separate lives, but it's an integrated Jewish life that you live at home and in the street. And then you had the seculars, or the secular humanists, or the Yiddish culturalists, who rejected any notion of formal religion but had an ethnic connection to Judaism. Mm. So you had four competing groups. To some degree, we still have them today. And in different parts of the world, different groups tend to dominate.
Can I break that into little pieces? Because I've got about, I think, 15 things I'd like to ask you about how you'd respond to each one. And this, I think, will give the listener a sense of, oh, so that's where they sit compared to what I think Judaism is. Could we start with something like dietary laws? Now, of course, everybody would know that the Torah, the first five books, and in particular Leviticus and also Deuteronomy, teaches things about what you can and can't eat. Now, how far in the Reform movement where you sit do those things apply strictly, or are they personal? How does it work?
Well, I'll hold up a headline for you, which comes from a Jewish paper in North America that came out last week, and the headline is about a new Pew study. It says 57% of U.S. Jews eat pork, and
good
Torah
Lord.
Study is gaining in popularity. Now, you try reconciling those two statements to someone who sees every word of the Bible as the word of God. They seem totally contradictory. The progressive Jews, Reform Jews around the world, see the Torah as a divinely inspired document, but written by human beings. So it reflects how human beings, at the particular time the text was written, interpreted what was required of them in their relationship to God. We might be writing a very different kind of text if we were writing it in 2015, but we don't consider the Torah to be divinely written, which is something a modern Orthodox Jew or a Hasidic Jew would consider. Rather, we consider it to be a document written by human beings, inspired by God.
It strikes me, because I come out of a Christian background where I studied this stuff from a Christian perspective, that in the 19th century there was a rise of what we referred to as biblical criticism, because science had arisen. People were looking at Genesis, for example, and saying, can the world really be only 6,000 years old? Is that really it? And it seems to me almost that when I was reading about this, that the first forms of Reform Judaism and liberal Judaism that I understand, this 19th century stuff, seem to arise at the same time that these science criticisms are arising. Is that a fair
Absolutely.
Observation?
If you look at the first institution of rabbinical school for Reform Judaism, it was called the Institute for the Wissenschaft des Judentum, the Institute for the Scientific Study of Judaism, and it's exactly the kind of critical text reading that you'd see in any contemporary Protestant denomination in the 19th or early 20th century.
Ah, bats, birds, for example. You know, these sorts of things which are in Genesis, but you think, oh, how do we reconcile that with our understanding of science?
And that's the eternal religious dilemma, is reconciling our inherited texts with our contemporary understanding of the universe. We do not see any conflict between the two, and we see the biblical creation story as a parable of sorts, but who knows how long a day is? We're absolutely not accepting the Torah and the Bible as the literal word of God.
It sounds like there is almost like a parallel among Christians, because there are some Christians who will insist that the world is 6,000 years old still and that evolution does not exist. And I imagine there are some Orthodox Jews who may wish to take that position too.
There are, and that's the contrast between fundamentalist religions and what we call progressive religions. you know, those who are fundamentalists don't see themselves as backwards, but rather see themselves as absolutely believing that what is written in the text has higher authority than anything else that they might read.
Let me ask you another thing, the keeping of the Sabbath. Now, I have Orthodox Jewish friends who would not answer their phone. They would not smoke. They live close to their shul, to their synagogue, so that they can walk. They can't drive. They won't turn on the lights physically. It's very strictly interpreted how much rest means and how work is and what you cannot do on the Sabbath. How does that sit for progressive Judaism?
Well, progressive Jews, Reformed Jews, also observe the Sabbath, but they observe the Sabbath as a day of rest. Now, the rules that your Orthodox friends may be observing are post-biblical. They're rabbinic rules. Mm-hmm. They're interpretations of how Jews in various centuries have chosen to observe the Sabbath. They're not part of the Torah or the Bible at all. And we'll pretty much observe the biblical restrictions here of not working on that day. So how might I interpret it?
Well, a rabbi, for example, who is supposed to actually conduct services, is that not determined as work?
Well, you know, no one drove cars in biblical times.
Right.
So the prescription is not to light a fire on the Shabbat, not to carry things from one domain to another. Mm-hmm. So I am, to go to a worship service, I have no problem with driving on the Sabbath. To go to a mall is a different story. But to use modern conveniences to allow me to have a day of rest and to allow me to participate in communal worship, there is no distinction. There are other things that I do put restrictions on myself. I don't answer email on the Sabbath. I will watch television on the Sabbath for relaxation, but I won't sit and write an article or an essay about what I'm watching.
So it's very much about interpretation, looking at what the Absolutely. Scripture actually says and then saying, what does this mean in my life now?
And from my mind, frankly, we're all interpreting all the time. We're all making choices, religious choices for ourselves. There are very few human beings who go to a religious expert for every single detail of their life. Mm. That's our free will.
Of course, we live in a world where everybody's reading about ISIS. Everybody's worried about extremism of its sorts. You've told us about some of the more extreme versions within Judaism of fundamentalism, as you talked about it. But what about interfaith work? Where do progressive Jews stand on that stuff? Discussions with Islam, discussions with Christians, discussions with Yazidis. Where do you stand in those sorts of things?
Well, we can only thrive in a pluralistic, tolerant society that accepts multiple places on the religious spectrum. So we want to very firmly defend the right of Muslims to practice their religion, Christians to practice their religion, Jews to practice their religion in our civil society, but not to impose their religion on anyone else and not to perform any acts that undermines the fabric that holds the community together. The recent violence in Paris and in Mali and so many places we've watched this week is unacceptable religious behavior. We're using religion to impose our values on others rather than to enhance our lives, to allow us to be more productive, loving members of society. And it's a different vision of religion, and it exists in every religion, of the need to that there's only one true way to be human being, and that is to interpret Islam or Christianity or Judaism in our way. And we do not believe that at all. We don't believe that's healthy for the future of the world. We don't think it's healthy for the future of any particular society, and that we need to marginalize people who take extreme positions rather than mainstream them. So the best thing that I can do, and you and I can do now, is to go and visit Paris and go and visit Israel, and to, yes, assemble in public places and to be very cautious, but not allow those that want to impose their religious beliefs on us to gain the upper hand and to think that they've terrorized us and to not being willing to build a loving civil society.
Rabbi Danny Freelander, President of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, I've been grilling you. I think we should take a piece of music before we push on. What's your second choice today?
Well, my second choice is a melody that I wrote 40 years ago.
I heard you were a musician.
And I was a musician first, and I always thought I'd be able to make a living as a musician. I found that was not really possible. So I decided to enter the clergy and to keep music as a side piece of mine, and I've really never given it up. And my compositions really are liturgical texts that I was trying to find a way that personally expresses how I feel about them and makes them real for me. And while I've written many melodies, only a few have risen to the level of becoming traditional. Mm-hmm. So if you walk into a progressive synagogue and ask them to sing the traditional melody for Shalom Rav, Great Peace, a part of our evening worship service, they might sing this melody and say, oh, it's several hundred years old. I know it's only 40 years old.
It's a sign of acceptance. But before we play it, I believe this is also you singing.
Yes, it's me singing from many years ago, so you're getting to hear me in my younger, stronger days, I guess.
Shalom Rav al Yisrael amcha tasim leolam. Shalom Rav al Yisrael amcha tasim leolam. Ki ata Tasim leolam, shalom rav al Yisrael amcha. Tasim leolam, tasim leolam, tasim leolam, tasim leolam.
Shalom Rav. That piece was both composed and then sung there. The cantor is Rabbi Danny Freelander, who's our guest here on Sunday Nights Around Australia. Rabbi Freelander, can we push on with a couple of other questions about how Judaism sits together, how you relate to one another? Because, of course, what we see on our news screens is complicated, particularly if you look at Israel, for example. In terms of the relationship or exchange between or talk with or interaction between, say, Orthodox and progressive Jews, what's it like in the USA, for example, where you come from? Is there much interaction, much exchange?
I don't think it's radically different than the situation that I'm experiencing here in Australia. Jews tend to have strong opinions and tend to associate with individuals who share their opinions, so that there is not considerable interaction between the Hasidic movement, the modern Orthodox movement, the Reform and progressive movements, and the secular community. They each seem to have their own organizing structure and their own leadership positions. Mm-hmm. One of the few things that does unify us is support for the State of Israel, mm-hmm. And fighting anti-Semitism. But beyond those two pieces, the groups rarely deal with one another because mm-hmm. they don't accept the basic premise under which the other group is operating.
It sounds like Christian denominations.
It is remarkably similar.
Well, can I ask you quite practically, though? Let's go to brass tacks, for example. I think we would know easily from press reports that of the millions of Jews in the United States, that the financial, moral, and political support of Israel in that nation is very important to Israel. It's very important. And most of those Jewish Americans are Reform, aren't they?
Absolutely. There are about 6.5 million Jews in North America, about 500,000 in Canada and 6 million in the U.S. And those Jews live in very populous states. They live in states where they vote as a significant bloc. Mm. And they pay a great deal of attention to what happens in Congress. and in the presidential elections to make sure that those individuals who we elect from our districts are strong supporters of Israel. The U.S. Provides over $3 billion a year in economic aid and military aid to Israel. And we are convinced, and I think most North Americans are convinced, that having a strong democratic and militarily strong Israel in the Middle East is absolutely in the West's interest.
Well, it's surrounded by hostile states, so its military development is necessary, of course, from its perspective and perspective of anybody who wishes its well.
You know, the United States knows that it has a, in all Western countries, a place where they can lend their jets if they need to be on bombing raids against ISIS. Mm. And it's a strong military outpost for the West. There's a self-interest for the Western countries.
Let me ask you again, then, about the way Zionism works, because this is, again, a 19th century
construct,
as it were.
And by the way, it was an opponent of Reform and modern Orthodoxy. It's one of the choices. My great-grandparents were all born in Russia. One family migrated to the U.S. in 1881, and another family migrated to Israel in 1911. So I have both sides. I have the Zionist side, which wanted nothing to do with religion, and I had the North American side, which very early on became early Reform Jews in North America. So my blood comes from both parts of it, but in my heart, both sides have become contemporary Zionists, if you will.
Yes. For the listener, can we unpack that a little bit? In the one sense that Zionism can mean a political commitment to Israel's establishment, which preceded the modern establishment, and it can be not religious at all. It might be completely secular. It also could be religious.
It cuts across all lines. Mm. It's support for the existence, the vibrancy of a Jewish state in Israel.
And here, Reform Judaism is committed to this, though,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. There's no light between any of the Jewish groups on their support for Israel. We can be very critical of the government of Israel, but that's not the same thing as our love of Israel and our commitment to the state.
Every time I read about Israel, I read about, for example, the Temple Mount faithful who want to rebuild the temple. There is a movement. I also read about extremely religious Jews who think Israel should not ever have been founded because we're waiting for Moshiach to come. That's when he's ready, then we're going to do it. And so there's even an element among the more extreme of the Orthodox who are not supportive of the state of Israel too, isn't there?
And I would say that within every religious community there's an extreme, there's a fringe. Mm. So yes, you can find some small groups living in Israel even who don't support the existence of a Jewish state, mm. or who will, when Netanyahu will come to New York or Washington, will march with Palestinians actively supporting the destruction of a Jewish state. Mm. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny fringe group. Similarly, you'll find groups on the other side who want to rebuild the temple, who want to recreate Judaism as it was 2,000 years ago.
Oh, the Christians do too, because they think it'll mean the second coming is going to come, so they're willing to help the Jews who want to build the temple as well. Good Lord.
And there's a strange alliance between certain fundamentalist Christian groups and certain Jewish groups around the world regarding Israel. I may be a little uncomfortable with it, not because of the nature of the Christian groups, but there's a fundamentalist aspect to it
which
troubles me.
It's part of the complexity of Israel, though, isn't it? All these little elements, as it were, but they're elements which can be very outspoken and deeply committed to what they think.
Well, it helps us understand that not all Jews are exactly the same, and I would say not all Australians are exactly the same.
Nor all Christians, let me tell you.
We may have radically different opinions, but we certainly identify ourselves as Christians, as Jews, as Australians, as Muslims as well.
Can I ask you, this may be a difficult question, but I'm interested to know where you come from, because you lead a very significant part of Jewish people. In terms of the place of Christians and Muslims within the Israeli state as citizens, I'm interested to know where you stand on that.
Well, I think religious tolerance is, and pluralism within Judaism and within the state of Israel is absolutely crucial to Israel living up to its potential as a model for what a society can be. So it's absolutely crucial to pay very careful attention to how the state of Israel treats its Christian and Muslim citizens, how it allows for the open practice of religion. That's part of the Israeli Statement of Independence, Declaration of Independence in 1948, to protect all religious rights within Israel. It's in Israel's best interest to protect the sanctity of the Temple Mount as a mosque, to protect the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Those are in that's the living out of the Jewish values that established the State of Israel. Now, there's a tension there. There are those in the Israeli government who don't want to extend those rights, say, to other Jews, like progressive Jews, and there's same individuals sometimes who don't want to extend those rights to non-Jews. My wife was arrested in Israel about 2 years ago in December for participating in a prayer service at the Western Wall wearing a tallit, wearing a ritual garb. And she was...
She was one of the women arrested.
Oh, yes.
We saw that reported here.
And so my family was visiting in Israel, and we were waiting for her to come back to the hotel. Couldn't find her. Went to Jerusalem and discovered that my children and I had to bail her out. But she's a rabbi, and she wore her regular tallit, but it was not allowed in that section because the ultra-Orthodox Jews that control that section saw that as a desecration of their form of Judaism. And we believe that that area belongs to all Jews, and that the area of the Temple Mount above belongs to all religions, not just to Jews. We're not exclusive in our sense of that we are the only way to practice Judaism or the only way to be a good human being.
Rabbi Danny Freelander, it's been fascinating. We are out of time, but I would like to ask you to tell us one more piece of music you've chosen for us to go out on and tell us what we're going to listen to.
Well, there was a poet who escaped the Nazis in 1943, a woman named Chana Senesh, who escaped to Palestine and became a partisan. She was returned to Hungary to fight the Nazis, and she wrote a series of poetry while she was walking on the beach on the Mediterranean Ocean. And one of her songs appears in our Reform, our Progressive Prayer Book, and it talks about the stars in the sky that you see at night as being human beings whose light has not extinguished. It's still up there and still influencing us. And the stars that light up the darkest night, they're the lights that guide us. And so I, Cantor Jeff Klepper, a very dear friend of mine, and I translated this text into English and then sing it in Hebrew with a contemporary melody. We are beholden to those that came before us. They light the way for us. Jews that lived 2,000 years ago and 100 years ago helped create me and my family and my world. I'm grateful to them, and I'm grateful that I continue to see their lights shining in the sky.
Rabbi Danny Freelander, President of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, thanks for being part of Sunday Nights.
Thank you.
Rak kasher hem atzmam avdu ve'enam Yesh anashim sheziv zichram meir Kasher hem atzmam enam od betochenu Orot ele hama Beheshkat halayil Hem hem shemarim ladam Et haderet, et haderet Hem hem shemarim ladam Et haderet
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio.